And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU, bringing you the news you don't ordinarily get to hear in the corporate media. We're broadcasting to Hamilton via the FM dial on 93.3 and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And today we are delighted to have Canadian author, activist, and journalist Anthony Fenton on the program today. Together with Eve Engler, Anthony wrote Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. He follows Canadian foreign policy very closely, and he's a regular contributor to the Dominion and other publications. Anthony, thanks very much for being on the program today.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a while. We're very lucky to hear from Anthony. He's very busy in a graduate program at York right now. He's been one of our regular featured guests, but it's been a little difficult to get a hold of Anthony. You've been looking at the Canadian military, the Department of National Defense, aspects of how it's trying to normalize itself. What is it that you're focusing on right now in your research?
Mainly, I've just been looking at partly at what we're going to be talking about today. But mostly, just I'm studying Canadian political economy and international relations, but I've been looking at sort of the composition of the Canadian ruling class, you could say, and I've been tying that into you know how, for example, the history of Canadian foreign policy and national security type think tanks and how they've evolved and how they interact with Canadian corporations and things of that nature. So, a few other things, but continuing to follow Canada's role in Afghanistan. Of course, the war in Libya was a particular preoccupation recently, and watching the ongoing transformation of the entire apparatus of the Canadian foreign policy and national security establishment.
Wow, the Canadian ruling class, the military-industrial complex. When you're talking about Canada's 1 or 2%, this is a very timely issue. You've got, with the Occupy movements in Canada and the United States, you're looking at the actual dynamics of how class systems, how differentiation between economic groupings and Canadians occurs. That's very important, and you've always been looking ahead, forward thinking. Your work that you did on the issue of Haiti prefigured some of the other interventions that we would see, like the one in Libya, for example. So you've been able to follow very closely the direction of our government. And the wars are another important issue very closely related to those other subjects. We've got wars all around us, even in Canada, the war in Libya. The government is putting pressure on Iran and Syria. The United States is still in Iraq. And behind it all, here in Canada, we have this 11-year war in Afghanistan. And I guess you've been looking at some of the dynamics as to how that was pitched and justified and legitimized here in Canada specifically. I remember the outset of the conflict and reading the newspapers, the letters to the editor back in 2001, 2002. It seems to me that they weren't selling that war as a 10-year occupation at the beginning. It's kind of a cliche, but I think I remember one Canadian officer quoted as saying that they'd be home by Christmas, essentially, that combat operations would take a matter of months and troops would be able to return to their families. I wish I'd kept that article, but am I remembering things correctly? They weren't saying that it would be a decade-long war at the time, were they?
Yeah, certainly not. I certainly don't recall seeing anything of that nature. You know, of course, they play, you know, it's very incremental, the way that this has unfolded. I bet you that you could put them on a lie detector test and they wouldn't have believed themselves at the time they're going to be involved in a decade-long quagmire in Central Asia. Even then, though, like that was when the Canadian forces were still kind of coming out of what, you know, later Chief Defense Staff Rick Hillier called the decade of darkness for the Canadian forces. They're on the cusp of transforming themselves out of putting the Cold War era behind them, launching themselves into the 21st century of what they're calling then was the revolution in military affairs. That was the buzzword. They were already in 2001. They were seeing and beginning to incorporate into the Canadian military's ethos this notion of a three-block war and an asymmetric warfare. It's focused mainly on urban type environments, not like in Afghanistan, more like the type of wars we saw in Haiti, you could say, and in Iraq as well. But it didn't really happen until about 2005 when Canada committed to the counterinsurgency war in the south of Afghanistan, that what we saw a concerted perception war, the war at home, right? The war for Canadian public opinion and so forth.
Yes, that's the way I see it as well, and the way I remember it. At the outset of the war, in the first few years, there was this large external focus of things that we, the Canadian government and military, were doing for Afghans. We were helping Afghan women. We were building schools and things like that. And they'd look at Canadian soldiers distributing candy in villages and talk about what the Canadian soldiers were doing in Afghanistan. But then there was a shift where bringing the military home, in a sense, trying to get ordinary citizens more accustomed to military presence, military operations, the fact that there would be ongoing operations and the idea that that's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Before 2005, there was pretty scant coverage. If you go, I remember going through the databases, just trying to compile all the coverage of the war there. Now, of course, there were reporters going down, but they didn't really, I don't think it was until 2005, unless I'm mistaken, that the Canadian Forces, for example, followed the U.S. lead in establishing an actual media embedding program with the media. And then you saw regular tours of duty, so-called, by every major Canadian newswire and media agency. And that is when it used to be front-page news. And, of course, this is all because, it was all preceded, rather, by the so-called body bag tour, right? They knew that there had been very few casualties taken by the Canadian forces in Afghanistan because they're in relatively peaceful area of the war there in Kabul for the most part. As far as we know, we don't know where Joint Task Force 2 forces, Canadian Special Operations Forces were, for example. But the point is that it was when they said, okay, we know there's going to be body bags coming back home, and they know that there's a correlation between body bags and public sentiment possibly souring against wars. So they wanted to be able to preemptively sort of mitigate any potential fallout in the realm of public opinion that would have come about. So they launched this body bag tour with the chief of defense staff, Rick Hillier. But it's interesting, though, the timing, right? I mean, in 2005, Rick Hillier became the chief of defense staff, and that sort of correlated with this intense, what Brian Stewart with CBC called him, a really illuminating documentary on this very topic of the perception war, of the public relations war led by the Canadian military. This was in 2007, but people can catch it online. I'm sure it's called Selling the Forces. But what he called was, this is one of the greatest military promotion efforts in Canadian history, began after Hillier took Chief of Defense Staff in 2005. But in 2004, when Hillier was the head of the Army, very quietly, wasn't even reported on at the time, he created for the first time ever a psychological operations branch in the Canadian Army, and that's still exists. And that was sort of a very important sort of institutional shift that was indicative of how the very Canadian forces were transforming to be fighting not only this war in Afghanistan. See, that's one of the other things we come across in the research, is that this is the transformation of the Canadian forces. It wasn't just for one war, it's for future wars beyond that. We're already seeing beyond Afghanistan, right, in terms of Libya, possibility of Syria, and so forth. But Africa, Canadian Special Operations Forces over there. But the timing of this, right, so there's a very clear an engagement of the military with questions of psychological operations, of public relations, and what they call public affairs, that really began 2004, 2005, with this body bag tour.
Well, there's definitely a multifaceted campaign. It's in more than one area or a segment of Canadian society. And a number of writers, Tyler Shipley over at York and Derek O'Keefe in BC and others, have been looking at, for example, sports in Canada and how the military is insinuating itself there, trying to become a regular part of activities, much as you saw in the United States, especially under Bush. And there's other areas of Canadian society as well, but certainly sports are very important here in Canada. And there was a controversy recently over the Winnipeg Jets logo. And for those who might not have been aware, that's when the new logo was brought in, of course, which was a representation of a CF-18 fighter jet, and broke with tradition, broke with the earlier insignia. And there's a lot of interesting dynamics there. But what do you think is the significance of the relaunching of the Jets in that case?
Yeah, I mean, it's just another example of sort of entrenching within the Canadian society, the body politic, however you want to put it, of this this notion that the Canadian military is here and they're here to stay. And it's almost like an ongoing sort of addition, a new layer on top of an already existing sort of presence patrol we've seen within Canada, by way of new marketing and recruiting campaigns that for the first time you'll have this sort of overt warrior ethos embedded into commercials and so forth. But it was part of the broader effort begun again under Hillier in 2005. They actually instituted what's called the Operation Connection. They created a public affairs unit within the Department of National Defense that coordinated 500 uniformed and civilian public affairs staff worldwide. They were getting $23 million a year budget to spread the Canadian Forces message across Canada, as Brian Stewart says, to every community in Canada. In Afghanistan, there were more of these media advisors than there were Canadian aid workers.
That's another thing too, in terms of what we're shown overseas, because Don Cherry, or if they're showing segments at hockey games or in televised segments where they give us a switch over overseas and take a look at the troops and what they're doing, they focus on our frontline combat troops. They don't so much look at humanitarian aid workers, doctors, other personnel, or what our diplomatic staff are doing. So there's a limited focus. But in terms of having this giant staff, it's significant that they have put multi-million dollar budgets into this year after year after year, and still you have probably a majority of the Canadian population, usually over 50%, saying that we should get out of Afghanistan. So despite all this effort and all the areas in which this campaign can intervene, from sports to television to radio and elsewhere, it's of limited effectiveness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard. It's harder to measure than that, I think, in the sense that, like, it could almost. My sense is that it has helped to disorganize people, even if they're opposed to war. People are more inclined to not speak out because of this sort of like support the troops. Remember this language that we've seen. I mean, I was tracking, for example, the sort of legislation. De facto, like on a civic sort of municipal level, of these yellow ribbon magnets, for example, that police units and police departments and fire departments and other municipal type agencies were making it mandatory for their vehicles to have yellow ribbons, which are support the troop ribbons on their vehicles. It's things like that that operate on the grassroots level that were really important, but I think it also did help to stifle debate and dissent and so forth. And we saw this not too long ago when a number of professors at the University of Regina wrote a public letter opposing the incorporation of this thing that Rick Hillier helped found called Project Hero, which is a private effort to provide scholarships to the sons and daughters of deceased soldiers, not in Afghanistan per se, but it was really correlated, and it ascended with and was developed during the war in Afghanistan, of course. But when they spoke out, there was this massive backlash against them. The media themselves, were outraged that these professors, these radicals and Jeffrey Weber, who's a former graduate of York, I think, was in the University of Toronto, was one of them. Who would go on and debate these media personalities who are just visibly, like, I'm thinking of Tom Clark at CTV, for example. He was angry that these professors could suggest that this could have anything to do with militarization, that had these Project Hero scholarships. And so it's a very interesting dynamic to see the reaction. And then, of course, the reaction by the hawks, the Canadian media hawks. There's a whole host of them that we've seen providing their viewpoints on the military in the Canadian media, who came out and said, this is ridiculous. They're not militarizing campuses. This is and so on and so forth. Right, using patriotic type rhetoric, and like that's part of what the support to the troops rhetoric in general has done. It's basically, if you don't support the troops, you're basically anti-Canadian.
Well, the troops rhetoric in the United States and Canada is kind of an anti-thinking or end of thought rhetoric. It makes you stop thinking, because they just say support the troops and they want you to stop there. They don't want you to think about the war or the government policy behind the war or the political decisions of the prime minister and his staff. So all that is off the table. It just, they want it to be limited to a discussion of the troops.
Yeah, so that's what Noam Chomsky said in one interview. Support the troops, what they really mean is support the policy, right?
But no one will say that, because if you say support the policy, people will say no, so you got to hide behind the troops.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, you're saying that there's this campaign which disorganizes opposition to the war. And I can see how that would be the case. How, for example, when you have sporting events, I recall reading at one, there was a light armored vehicle parked in the hockey rink where the Zamboni would normally be. There was another event where Canadian forces rappelled down from the ceiling. And I mean, that's very entertaining. It's like when the police come to your elementary school and show you all the things that they do. You know, it's very entertaining, but it happens in game after game after game all across the country. And so anyone who's wishy-washy on the issue or thinking about it is just going to come to feel that the military and its presence and its operations are part of regular, ordinary life here all the time.
Right, and that's just it, right? They need to permeate the culture, right? And in a way that what Rickler said, the goal of that Operation Connection, the goal was to change the mindset of the Canadian public. And that's what I mean by, like, it's hard to measure the effects of the propaganda, right? The one thing they wanted to avoid was another Somalia type situation, which a lot of people probably don't even remember. But what happened was that, you know, the Canadian forces were shamed for their involvement in the torture and the death. Right? You actually, I'm sure you've covered this on the show. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole, you know, public inquiry and so on and so forth. But a lot of the main questions about the Canadian military and Canadian military culture within Canada were left unaddressed. And of course, Shireen Razak's great book on that process is very enlightening. And but one of the questions of that is attached to this is also part of changing the mindset was changing the mindset of Canadians who think that Canada is a peacekeeping country. You know, so changing the myth, right? Changing from one myth of Canada the peacekeeper to a new myth, you know, Canada the warrior nation.
I'm glad you bring this up because I wanted to ask you about this. This is a confusing issue. It's certainly the case that people like General Rick Hillier and others have been promoting this warrior ethos where they've said we are now a war-fighting nation. People like Ignatieff are talking about robust intervention and putting boots on the ground. So the idea is that the Canadian Army is a war-fighting force that goes onto foreign territory and sorts people out in their language. And so we're being told that we're abandoning this anemic peacekeeping tradition that was holding us back from doing the right thing or holding us back from our position on the world stage, keeping up with the United States. But sometimes, I mean, there's a bit of a contradiction here because even now, if you read the Globe and Mail editorial section or some of our Canadian newspapers, the comments, when they talk about Syria or Libya, they'll call it a peacekeeping operation. They'll say, we're peacekeepers and we need to help the people in various countries. So it's a bit confusing for me because on the one hand, for the last 10 years, they've been saying, we're not peacekeepers anymore. We are soldiers and fighters. But then when it comes time for a humanitarian intervention, they turn around and say, oh, we're a peacekeeping nation. Can they have their cake and eat it too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're trying to. I mean, well, of course, Libya was the first, the so-called first test case of the doctrine of humanitarian intervention called the responsibility to protect, undertaken under the liberals. This is the first sort of open advocacy of R2P preceding an intervention. It was literally the first R2P war, Libya was. Yeah, but at the same time, I don't think the government themselves would say, or the Canadian forces certainly weren't saying we're peacekeepers. It's more so, I'm assuming you mean it's the media.
Oh, yes, commentators and pundits and whatnot.
Yeah, it's like they're trapped. They're trapped in the mythological discourse of peacekeeping as well, I guess.
Yes, but I think you're very clear in saying that the military has definitely adopted the war-fighting direction, and that's the stance that they're taking now.
Yeah, for now. I mean, this isn't just words as far as that side of it goes, right? This whole process is correlated with an unprecedented modernization of Canadian expeditionary capabilities on a global scale. I mean, they are, for example, for the first time ever, establishing mini military bases in foreign countries. So they've signed one of these agreements with Kuwait. I think they're looking into one with Jamaica and a couple of others. They're increasing their alliances in the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, signing very much. Of course, we have to link this to, you know, Canada and the world economy, you know, like the fact that the Canadian flag is in these regions increasingly, because of course the Canadian Navy also has been continuously active working hand in glove with the U.S. Navy, patrolling the waters in and around the Gulf, and in and around other bodies of water where there are also intense military activities taking place. But it's important that we've seen a shift in capabilities. We've seen a shift in Canadian military doctrine. So this whole counterinsurgency turn, the development, following the, I mentioned 2004, the psychological operations branch, that actually preceded the first ever counterinsurgency doctrine from the Canadian forces. And it's really, I remember listening a couple times to Andrew Leslie, who was the head of the Canadian Army. He's since retired after issuing that controversial report saying that they need to make some serious cutbacks in the Canadian forces. But he was saying, we have to think beyond Afghanistan, right? I mean, it's the next operation that they're thinking ahead towards. And so they really needed to establish roots, new roots with this new ethos, and because it's here to stay as far as they're concerned. And partly that's also owes to sort of this bizarre and increasing influence of the military within the sort of the overall Canadian apparatus. But this whole security culture too, in the post 9/11 context, has also helped to fuel this whole situation, because and of course also very important that we have to mention is the increasing integration of the Canadian sort of foreign policy establishment with the U.S. foreign policy and national security establishment. So closer than ever military integration with the United States, closer than ever intelligence cooperation with the United States, closer than ever border patrolling and so forth, and these are alarming things that are setting in stone. That's sort of what this war perception partly is being fought for more broadly.
There's definitely a number of things going on here in terms of the military procurement and purchases. We purchased some expensive new transport aircraft recently, and that'll enable us to send troops and supplies around the world. You've got the F-35s, which I don't think they fully explain why we need them, but there seems to be this assumption that Canadian forces will be operating overseas around the world more than not. And it's tied, as you say, to the integration with U.S. policy, which means the U.S. war on terror, this continuing war. And when you integrate the military into civilian society, it goes right down to the fabric of our country. Even new Canadians are being introduced to this. There was the story in the Globe and Mail about Harper militarizing the citizenship ceremony. So according to Joe Friesen, he says the Conservative government is strengthening the symbolic power of the military by having a member of the Canadian forces play a prominent role in citizenship ceremonies. So that's what the new citizens get to see, that there will be Canadian forces members there. It's an important part of the country and so on. So you got to start from the ground up, from our newest Canadians, I guess.
Right, and in fact, I believe also is not just the ceremonies themselves, but also the citizenship guides are now, the military is emphasized more strongly, and it's very much more overt. So when you now come to Canada, you're going to know what everyone else is becoming to know, that the Canadian forces are a prominent part of the Canadian identity, whatever that means, right? I mean, right. So, it's very, very interesting. We have to wonder, are the Winnipeg Jets going to change their, when the F-18s are retired finally and they have the F-35s, are they going to change their logo then?
Well, it's interesting. The F-18 is currently in service, and that's the image the Winnipeg Jets have chosen to project. A very corporate logo, by the way. You had mentioned corporations and that kind of influence. That logo stands out as being distinctly non-traditional in terms of Canadian hockey, and it's been criticized on that front. But it represents an existing combat aircraft that's in service right now, and I think a lot of the people on the receiving end of the CF-18 might not be so fond of it. And the Winnipeg Jets logo, it's a definite political statement, because some defenders of the new logo have tried to say it represents the tradition of the Jets and the military presence, the Air Force presence in that area around Winnipeg. But the logo is not a classic Canadian aircraft. It's not one of our, the old CF-100s. It's not some World War II fighter. It's not a biplane. It's a current service aircraft that's being utilized right now. And I think that's partly, or at least somewhat significant.
Right, of course, it's not even manufactured in Canada.
No.
U.S.
No, they make a big deal about how there's a light mounted on it that's distinctly Canadian. I'm not sure if that's even true, but that's, yes. We've always got to be a little bit special. Well, you know, you talk about the militarization of Canadian society, and certainly Harper, the big expenses he has on the horizon or the big purchases are the fighter jets and the prisons. That's his plan for the future. So it's definitely part of a domestic shift in politics, especially under this current government. But with the kind of research that you're doing, looking at Canada's place in the global economy, our integration in several respects with the United States, and the position and role of our elites in Canada, I mean, that is very promising research, and I think it's going to be very interesting to discuss that with you. So I know we have to get going today, but you're going to have to keep us updated once you've gotten through more research. This very timely topic of Canada's 1% that you appear to be looking at is going to be of great interest to our listeners. So I look forward to speaking to you about some of these larger issues as well and their connection to militarization. It seems like you're doing some very promising research.
Oh, thanks, Vin. Yeah, I look forward to the time we can discuss it. Maybe a few more years, you'll pin each other down. And thanks again for having me on the show, and I'd be happy to come back on and discuss anything with you.
Oh, absolutely. That sounds great. Okay, well, thanks very much, Anthony.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
And that's Canadian author, journalist, and activist Anthony Fenton. Again, he wrote Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, together with Eve Engler. Both Eve and Anthony are knowledgeable about Canadian foreign policy and what guides it, the interests of Canadian corporations and elites and the government and our relationships with a number of countries, both allied countries and countries in which we conduct business. Very interesting, and I imagine Anthony has had a field day looking at Libya and the recent intervention there.